This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Conversation with someone when they have that revelation.
Like, why are you
freezing?
It's making sure.
How does this work as a national story?
Well, it's so open, San Francisco.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every year, the New Yorker throws a huge festival that lasts the whole weekend. We bring in all kinds of people from the arts, entertainment, politics, history, technology, everything, for live conversations with the New Yorker's writers and editors. Today we're going to hear two of those events. The singer and songwriter Andrew Bird will talk with a fan of his, Atul Gawande, who's a medical reporter for the New Yorker, and he's also a practicing surgeon, and when he's in the operating room, he listens to Andrew Bird's music. But we're going to start off in a very different place, in the end game of the presidential election that just will not go away. We've assembled a group of experts to talk about the first term of President Trump. Yeah, I said it, President Trump. Now, as of today, that might seem hypothetical. Let's put it that way. Our panelists met on the weekend the Billy Bush tape hit the news, and Trump's fall in the poll was already starting to spiral downward. But as Harry Truman reminds us by way of Casey Stengel, it ain't over till it's over. And the way this godforsaken election has gone, with videotapes turning up and Russians hacking and accusations of rigging, it would be a mistake to pretend that a Clinton victory is an absolute lock. So let's take a few minutes to consider seriously. What would a Trump administration look like? You might want to grab a libation of some sort. The conversation includes Roger Stone, a political strategist who calls himself a Goldwater conservative.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. And now I know how the Christians felt when they were led into the arena. See, this is a, they call you a conspiracy theorist when you challenge the mainstream media narrative in any way. No, I'm a conspiriologist. I try to ferret out the facts. I don't carry water for the Republicans or the Democrats, the Bushes or the Clintons. I do think we have a political elite that has run the country into the ground.
Until he Max Boot is a commentator and national security analyst.
Well, Evan, I'm heartbroken by the condition of the Republican Party. I've been a Republican a long time. I have always voted for the Republican presidential candidate, going all the way back to 1988 when I voted for George H.W. Bush, who was a good man. And that streak will be broken in a month because I will vote for Hillary Clinton without any hesitation because...
And Sean Wilentz is a Princeton University historian and a Clinton supporter who has studied presidential campaigns going back to the founding of the Republic.
It's an abnormal election. It's really not an election. It's a national crisis. I mean, this is not an election. We call it an election because there are parties and it's been there, but something happened that is abnormal. There is no common ground. There cannot be any common ground because of the nature of the process that we're...
They're all joined by The New Yorker's political columnist, Amy Davidson, who's written critically about both candidates, but makes absolutely no bones about her preference. and the conversation is moderated by Evan Osnos, who reports for The New Yorker from Washington. Here's Evan.
So the day after, Max, this is a serious question in terms of what happens on the day after this election. Because let's assume for the moment, that's our topic today, that President Trump has been elected. There are a lot of Republican national security officials who have declared their intention never to support Donald Trump. I live in Washington, D.C. I know folks who say to me, look, this is Washington. If he's elected, it's not a political choice to go into a Trump administration. It's a patriotic act. If your president calls, you go. Do you think other Republican national security officials would join a Trump administration?
I'm sure some would.
Should they?
I think it's a very difficult choice. I mean, I personally could not possibly serve under somebody I regard as an American fascist. Others will make a different decision.
And if they do, will you come out publicly? And do you think other Republicans would come out publicly to denounce that choice?
Well, I would focus not on denouncing the appointees. I would focus on denouncing the president, who's the decision maker. And I think, as you pointed out, Evan, in your excellent piece on what Trump could do as president, it's actually pretty terrifying to understand the extent of executive authority in this country. There is so much he can do that Congress would not serve as a check and balance on him, especially not in the realm of foreign policy, where he can do so many destructive things by fiat. I would say, you know, he could actually destroy NATO, an alliance that has been the most successful in world history and has kept the peace in Europe for more than six decades. He could destroy it overnight. All he has to do is come out and say, I will not honor our commitments to all these freeloaders in Europe. If they're invaded by Russia, they're on their own. As commander-in-chief, he has the ultimate authority, and he will exercise it.
Roger, if, in fact, Donald Trump loses the election on November 8th, would you advise him to concede and accept the legitimacy of the result?
As long as there's no irrefutable inference of fraud, yes.
Well, what does that mean? I mean, do you...
Voter fraud doesn't exist in America.
So let me put it another way, though. Let's put it another way. I mean, you've seen the same studies which show that the tiny, infinitesimally small number of votes that are actually fraudulent, it's not even a significant number.
Right. I'm more concerned about election rigging. If the Russians can hack and rig a machine,
Do you think Donald Trump will accept the result?
He should, unless there is any refutable evidence to the contrary.
Do you agree, though? I mean, as an American, as a patriot, do you agree that there would be great damage to the American democratic process if Donald Trump does not recognize the result of a legitimate election?
Unless there is widespread evidence of fraud. I would like to see exit polls compared to the actual machine results in certain precincts, in certain states across the country, so that we may be sure.
Those certain precincts, I mean, Trump always talks about sending poll watchers to certain precincts, which, I mean, I'm glad that Roger is so concerned about racism, but that what Trump is saying seems to be pretty not-so-coded racism, that he's worried that African-Americans will somehow cheat to vote for Hillary Clinton.
I don't think poll watchers would tell you much. A scientifically conducted exit poll, however, would.
I think Trump would probably suggest that we should rule based on internet polls.
Amy.
This is just to pick up on what Max was saying about what an executive is able to do. For example, to initiate military conflict with few checks. But I think we should also look at what, say, there is a war that Trump starts or doesn't start, what an executive can and has done in American history in the context of war and with the justification of war. One thing that people might remember is that a Supreme Court ruling that actually has never been officially overturned, this Korematsu, which is still in place. The idea that within the context of war, you can treat different citizens differently depending on their backgrounds. I think that that's something that will be a great concern under President Trump. I would also say that, you know, one of the few Supreme Court decisions that's up there in terms of terribleness with Korematsu is Dred Scott, which was basically overturned effectively by the 14th Amendment. But President Trump has talked about a radical and unconventional reading of the 14th Amendment that might give a different status to children whose parents were born in other countries. This is his whole, when he talks about anchor babies, that's what he's talking about. And then you have the question with the Supreme Court, not just is he going to appoint justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, but is he going to appoint justices who provide any sort of a check?
Sean, how strong is, in fact, the arrangement that a Trump president would inherit, the institutional setup? Every school child will tell you that there are checks and balances.
The president has a lot of power, period.
More than people think.
A lot, yeah. The president's the center of action. They can do a lot of things, foreign policy in particular.
Yep.
It's a great deal he can do in foreign policy. It requires no congressional action whatsoever, and that has only increased over time. Executive orders, all sorts of things can happen. I know he says he's against executive orders. Watch what happens. I know, a president is the most powerful figure in the American government, federal government, period. I don't have to say much more, I don't think.
Roger, when we think about what a Trump White House would look like, there have been a number of names that have been floated. I'd be curious, I think a lot of us want to know what that would actually, what it might look like. If you were going to imagine, if you were going to try to plot out, based on what you know and your sense of how the players interact with each other. Donald Trump, for instance, has talked about potentially Chris Christie as Attorney General. There's been talk about Bob Corker from the Senate being either Secretary of State or Secretary of the Treasury. Justice Sessions has been an idea that
Justice
people have
Cruz.
Floated. Justice Cruz perhaps has been floated by Mr. Cruz. What do you think? What do you think? Roger, can you map it out for us? What do you think it looks like? What does a Trump White House look like?
Well, since I think Chris Christie will be impeached as governor for lying to the people and then spending $10 million to cover his lie, which I wrote a year ago.
This is the head of the Trump transition team he's talking about.
And I was opposed to that appointment. I thought it was insanity. And I wish the guy would now step down. Who's your second example? I apologize.
The other one would have been, let's see, Bob Corker, perhaps. He's been talked about as Secretary of State for Treasury.
I actually think by the time that happens, Trump would become president, that he will be unconfirmable based on a series of stories that I think will break shortly regarding the senator and corruption. The Wall Street Journal's actually written extensively about this, but I believe we'll learn more.
What makes you believe that we'll learn more?
Because I am active in American politics, and I talk to a lot of reporters who I respect.
Yeah.
But I would hope that he would select people who are not neocons, people who are not connected to the two-party duopoly and the 30 years of bad decision-making that have gotten the country to where it is today.
What about Michael Flynn, who's been a
CIA director or Secretary of Defense? I think that would be a fine appointment.
One figure who Republicans have it in their power to put in the mix under President Trump is Justice Garland. You know, there's on the table a nomination. If the respectable Republicans really were concerned about what might happen under President Trump, that's one appointment that they have influence over right now.
I think that respectable Republicans line was directed at you, Max. Do you think, is there a scenario by which, and this is open to anybody, is there a scenario by which Merrick Garland gets confirmed?
Sure. I mean, I think it's crazy to hold that seat open for Donald Trump. I mean, Trump, you know, announced this list of judges that he would appoint. But, I mean, this is a guy who lies on average about once every 3 minutes, according to Politico magazine. So I would certainly not take his word on who the heck he would appoint. I mean, he could appoint Judge Judy to the Supreme Court as much as anybody else. So I think that the Republicans would be well advised to confirm Judge Garland, who is a pretty moderate liberal justice.
What are we not talking about when it comes to a Trump presidency? What is the thing that we really should be talking about what President Trump could do?
I mean, I'm still wondering about whether, you know, Hillary Clinton was really involved in a murder plot.
Roger, you know,
I'm fully expecting that by the end of this panel discussion, all of us will be implicated in the John F. Kennedy assassination.
I left out our last choice for president, by the way, which is a giant meteor crashing into the whole thing and taking us all out.
It's looking more attractive. I think it's worth noting, amidst all the other news, that we may have forgotten that yesterday the Office of the Director of National Intelligence announced with high confidence that the hacking of the Democratic National Committee this summer was not done by some random 400-pound couch potato sitting in his bedroom, as Donald Trump would have you believe, but was in fact done by Russia using WikiLeaks and Julian Assange as a front for this leak of information that was accessed by Russian intelligence hackers. We don't know exactly what Putin is up to, but there is certainly reason to believe that he sees an opportunity to influence the outcome of this election because he sees that the Republican Party this time around has nominated the most pro-Russian candidate in American history. He has a chance to reorient American policy fundamentally in a way that would allow him to dominate and even to conquer his neighboring countries.
Go ahead, Roger.
Two political appointees in the Obama administration say the Russians are going to hack our election. That doesn't make it so. They offer no evidence, even classified evidence. Let the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee see the proof of that. The CIA director said he was concerned about this 3 weeks ago. That's the tip-off that it's number one. Number two, we're discrediting Trump because he doesn't want war. He's not the war candidate, and we are hurtling towards war. This past week...
I think, actually, hold on. People are discrediting Trump because he has misstated the reality of Russian intervention in Ukraine. I mean, either because he didn't understand it or because he's deliberately trying to mislead the voters. You would agree that Vladimir Putin has invaded Crimea. Is that
this
right?
Pat, the whole meme that Trump is in bed with Russia... It's nonsensical. It's so ridiculous. You can keep repeating it, but I don't...
I would say three things. First, without diminishing the importance of cybersecurity and everything like that, I think that if we talk about Putin fixing the election and fixate on that too much, it's also a way of avoiding the question of why so many Americans do support Donald Trump and avoiding coming to terms with that and what that says about our political culture. Second, if Trump wins, and if the morning after that, Hillary Clinton's main point is that Putin did it, I think that's destructive. A third thing, I think that I'm not sure how clear a view Donald Trump has about the realities in Russia. I think that it may be most interesting and most important to our question today to think about what kind of president he would want to be. He wants to be like the cartoon he has of Putin, by which the Crimea, how much does Trump know about that? But he knows about the idea of a president who can act outside the law and act in an authoritarian manner. And that is the very, very highly alarming thing about the Putin.
I agree with that. And it's funny to me to hear Roger suggest that Donald Trump is the anti-war candidate. This is a guy who's actually said, I love war. I want it. I'm always sorry I didn't get a Purple Heart. He's also said that he wants to bomb, quote unquote, the out of ISIS. He wants to capture terrorist suspects. He wants to kill the families of terrorists. He wants to steal Iraq's oil. Think about the fact that Donald Trump has nasty, nasty comments about just about everybody in the world except for one person. He has never said one negative word about Vladimir Putin.
Amy, I want to talk about political culture. You know, we find ourselves now at a moment where you almost have to wonder whether it's okay to show a 9 or 10-year-old child the front page of the New York Times because of the language, because of the kind of the nature of our political discourse right now. And how did we get to this moment?
To this moment with when we're talking about President Trump coming up. I'm afraid I can't. My heart does not go out to the institutional Republican Party. I don't think it was obvious who Donald Trump was for the first time when he walked down, you know, came down that escalator. I think that who Donald Trump was, not in terms of the tackiness, not in terms of the crudeness, in terms of the raw racism, was clear to a lot of New Yorkers about somewhere in the early 90s when he was calling for the execution of three children who were accused of rape, the Central Park Five. If we hadn't had the news about the Billy Bush video, it might have been a bigger story that Trump again said he believed in the guilt of those then boys who were exonerated by DNA evidence. For a long time, he was the person who was also pushing birtherism. And if there's one person who might be most culpable for the respectability of Donald Trump, for his ability to get this far, I would argue that it might be Mitt Romney, who, you know, now is quite...
He's adamantly against Trump, right?
Well, you know, but he's sought out, went to Las Vegas in the midst of the birtherist movement, sought out his endorsement, talked about what a wise economic mind was, really brought him into the Republican Party and had him do paid advertisements on the behalf of his campaign. So what I resist is the idea, and I think this has a lot to do with what a Trump presidency would look like, that Donald Trump is a complete alien force who's descended on the Republican Party. There's a lot that you can say. I think that the subject of this panel is also the subject of a lot of daydreams on the part of Republicans about where their own ambitions fit in. Paul Ryan, who cringes every time Trump says something and yet has endorsed him and yet chaired the convention, you know, I'm sorry, and through it all, keeps saying that it's worth it because then President Trump, he's just going to sign whatever I get through the House. I think that we need to talk about how much the ambitions of the Republican Party have to do with where we are. And one of the questions is how deluded they are about how particular things are going to be realized.
I agree with you on Central Park Five. I was not at all happy when he raised that issue. I was equally unhappy when he started to advocate stop and frisk, and that they were super.
But now you mentioned two things that offended you that he's done. What would he have to do, frankly, Roger, to lose your vote?
That's an interesting question. Let me say this first of all: since he favors détente with the Russians, not war, which is what I think we're hurtling toward, which I think Hillary is for as a neocon. I think he favors a period of hard-headed negotiation, so perhaps we could get together and try to destroy ISIS, our common enemy. He's not running against Joan of Arc.
But hold on, there's a strategy question here for a second.
Yes.
There are 31 days till Election Day. If it was held today, he would lose.
Yes, but it's not.
What is he going to do? What is he going to do in the next 31 days?
But let me say this. In politics, 31 days is a lifetime.
So, Amy, you've been waiting patiently.
The funny thing is, after the last debate, there was a lot of talk of cheating. And I think that...
No, not cheating. Not interested in cheating. That's your interpretation. This is not about indiscretions. It's about violence against
women. No, I'm not talking about that kind of cheating. I was talking about the micro...
I'm reacting to something you wrote that I read just before we came
out. What I was trying to say was to get back to one of your initial questions about the political culture. What of those who have come out against Trump have said, I can never vote for him, all of the things that you've said, and then unlike you, they've said, but of course I couldn't vote for Hillary Clinton either. Either I'll write somebody in, or Gary Johnson, or maybe I'll just sleep late. My concern is that our political culture in a Trump presidency is going to be characterized by a renunciation of politics, by a sense that it's not the route to solve American problems.
Amy, I have one question for you. The truth is, you know, this is not what we're seeing right now in the United States. This surge of populism here is not isolated. You know, we're seeing versions of this in other countries. We've seen Angela Merkel's party suffered a defeat recently. We've seen a surge of this kind of anti-immigrant racist language in France. How do you see this phenomenon playing out? Is this going to come and go, or do you think we're entering into a new phase that's going to last a long time?
I don't think it will simply go. I think that there is an impulse that can take a lot of different shapes. I don't believe that President Trump is going to really do anything that speaks to those complaints, that really solves them, which is one reason I think that it'll just be crisis after crisis and alarm and search for a new enemy, which is an ugly place to be. But this has to be the moment then where both parties learn to talk to the American people and not talk in a demagogic and pandering or fear-mongering way. Maybe listen is a better word than talk, because there is something happening. Bernie Sanders, who came up, I have to say he's a bit of a contrast to a lot of the Republicans who are saying, I just can't endorse anybody. I don't like him, I don't like her. He's been out there in a way that I think shows his character in a quite admirable way, campaigning for Clinton and saying to people, like, these are the choices, and we're not going to give up on our political system, and we're not going to give up on democracy, and we're not going to give up on pursuing the interests of working people. And he's doing it through these instruments that we've been building for 200 years.
Well, we have covered a lot of ground. We are absolutely out of time. We're beyond time. This was a terrific audience. Thank you for your questions. And please join me in thanking this panelist for coming today.
President Trump. We heard from Amy Davidson, Roger Stone, Max Boot, and Sean Wilentz, with Evan Osnos moderating. Now we're going to take a blessed relief from politics, a big break. In a minute, we'll hear a conversation and live performance from the songwriter Andrew Bird. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The war in Syria has gone from bad to worse to horrendous, with the Russian military deeply involved and the U.S. facing unbelievably tough choices about how to engage. And meanwhile, the crisis in places like Aleppo is escalating all the time.
There is a situation now where people can really not leave their homes. They're petrified. And to say that people in Aleppo are petrified is shocking. It's surprising for me because these people are used to these bombs. They're used to barrel bombs and they've gotten used to it. But now they're petrified because they see that there is a clear intention to totally put this city into submission and there is nowhere to run.
Next week, we're going to go deep into the problem of the war in Syria and what the U.S. can do to move forward. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and today's show was recorded live at the New Yorker Festival, which took place this month. Now, Atul Gawande usually writes for the New Yorker about the practice of medicine. He's also a busy surgeon, a public health researcher, a father, the author of four best-selling books. But when he came to the New Yorker Festival, he didn't interview some innovator in cancer treatment. He wanted to talk to one of his favorite musicians. See, Atul is an absolute music nut. He listens to music even in the operating room, and he sent me his playlist for a recent day in the OR. It included Father John Misty's Strange Encounter, Lake Street Dive's Call Off Your Dogs, Beyoncé singing with Kendrick Lamar, Freedom, and Alabama Shakes' Don't Want to Fight. It also included a song called Puma by Andrew Bird. Atul adores Andrew Bird, who writes these gorgeous, melancholy songs, sometimes in a rock and roll vein, sometimes more acoustic. Bird plays guitar, violin, whistles like nobody else in business. And along with a looping machine, he's crafted the ultimate one-man band. So here's Atul Gawande with Andrew Bird.
I've been a fan of yours from the first album, 2003, Weather Systems. When I heard the next album, or two albums after that, Dark Matter, you said that, you know, when I was a little boy, I threw away my action toys
and devoted myself to playing Operation.
Yeah.
And I was just a little boy. I threw away all of my action toys while I became obsessed with Operation.
Did you really actually want to be a surgeon? Because I've been hoping.
No, I was more interested in psychiatry, actually. I wanted to be a psychiatrist. Seriously, yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Where did you grow up and how, and did you know you were interested in music? Were you actually, or were you thinking you might like to be a doctor?
Well, I grew up around Chicago, north of Chicago, in Lake Bluff, Illinois. And I started playing violin when I was 4. And it was just, it was something, it was my mom's idea. And I played Suzuki violin completely by ear for the first 10 years. And it's just something I did every week, almost every day of my life from before I was really a conscious human. So I didn't really think of it in terms of, and I still don't, as like a profession. So when I thought of like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? I thought, I like the interior design of the psychiatrist's office. I like the wood paneling and all the accessories. And I was curious about human behavior, but yeah.
You were growing up with lots of different interests as a kid.
Yeah.
What was the path that led you down this particular path, and what were the others that might have happened?
I didn't get really serious about music until I was maybe 15, when not much in your life is going very well, you know? And I was already pretty good at this, and I was looking for something, some sort of thing to feel good about. And I was like, wow, I already kind of have this in the bag, almost in half in the bag. And I threw myself into it in a sort of high school sort of, I'm going to be an artist sort of thing. And then my head was filled with all these lofty ideas. I'm going to be the greatest violinist. And it was my goth music, you know, in high school. I mean, all my friends were kind of the goth kids, but I didn't actually care for that music very much. I preferred, you know, Dvorak and Mozart's Requiem and all that stuff. It's the same thing.
You were truly goth.
I was old school goth, yeah. Yeah. But then I started practicing, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day. I got pretty fanatical about it.
You did classical music. By the time you went to college, it was with a focus on classical music.
Yeah, right? Violin performance, yeah.
And where were you in school?
At Northwestern.
And so what were you thinking would happen after that?
Well, at first I was thinking, I guess I'm going to do this classical thing. Although I was starting to get hints that maybe that was going to be tough and I wasn't really cut out for it. I didn't love being in orchestras and I didn't get along with my teachers so well. They were trying to show me how to do one thing and I was excited about, you know, Hungarian gypsy music. Or I was like, look, I want to improvise my own cadenza in this concerto, and they say, no, you have to play the transcription of the guy in 1880 who did this, you know. And I was like, I want to bring improvisation back to classical music, and they're like, no, just do the program, and then when you get out you can do what you want. Which by the time I got out, I was so eager to do what I wanted that I haven't read a lick of music since I left school.
When did you start to think, you know, maybe this violin and whistling would be the basis for fantastic rock and roll?
Well, I kind of backed into it. I didn't whistle at first because I thought, oh, that'd be too cute, you know. But I whistle, if you hung out with me for a day, it would drive you crazy because I whistle nonstop. I often say if I'm not eating or talking or sleeping, I'm whistling. no matter what mood I'm in. And so I didn't think to put that on a record until Swimming Hour. And then it's when I started playing solo and I noticed, and I did started doing the looping, that the timbre of the whistle really cuts through all the mid-rangey violin stuff. It was more like a mix thing. I'm just trying to use everything at my disposal to keep people's attention in a solo context. And the whistling, I would fill my lungs with air and just hold a note until people stopped their conversations. And then, and it was really effective, you know.
Because they wondered what the hell you were doing.
And there was like, what is that? What's that piercing sound? Yeah.
There's something maybe where I resonate so much with what you do, and to some extent The New Yorker does, because it's occupying the space between being challenging and wanting to be generally connecting with lots of people.
Right.
And yet being relatively demanding, 10,000 word stories on why we itch and a woman who, you know, scratched her way all the way through her skull. Oh, and
is that your article?
It was me.
Okay.
That was one of mine. But the kind of thing that
I read.
I'm not toying with you,
right?
But wanting to draw people in, but without the same tricks, right? That's what I think The New Yorker is generally trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's my approach to communication has generally been, yeah, a little bit perceived as maybe opaque or like or obtuse or whatever. But it's there for
cryptic,
you. If it's like there for you, if you want to dig into it, it's like, usually I start with a really strong melody and I'm compelled to sing that melody and I have a need for words. And I think, well, let's talk about something interesting. That's generally how I come at it.
This album is really different because it's so direct and personal. You're singing about meeting your wife, and you're singing about having a child. Love to play a few minutes from Puma. The first time I heard this song, I felt like I knew exactly what it was about, and I hadn't read anything about it, heard anything about it. If we could play Puma.
Do you see particles in the air? Ungodly particles in the air. Do you see particles in the air? Nobody notices, nobody cares. Oh, don't try to tell us she's less feline than human.
Just a tumor, and she was radioactive for 7 days. And as soon as I heard that line, I'm a endocrine surgeon. I do thyroid cancer care. And I'm like, this is a song about thyroid cancer. And the treatment you undergo for it involves being radioactive for 7 days. And the doctor tells you to stay away, only you made it this beautiful thing of because of the flying neutrinos and the gamma rays. But you wanted to hold her anyway. And you made this thing that's like a regular part of my life and what I do for people and turned it into art in a way that I didn't really even understand could be possible. It was this amazing thing. I mean, I play this song for patients now and I play it in my operating room. And being that direct is not something that you have wanted to do before. And I was really struck by you're letting it hang out there and be that personal. I don't think you're entirely comfortable being there, are you?
No, I had some major... I paused for sure when I was working on this song, but I mean, how could I go ahead and make another record and have gone through what we went through without, and completely omit these things that were so real and pervasive and just visceral. So basically that song opens with, do you see particles in the air? And this is when we were living in New York, in an apartment where you couldn't see much more than just a patch of sky out the window. And there's maybe an electrical wire. And have you ever had that experience where you look out at the air and you feel like you can see the subatomic particles? And it's probably just some dust, but either way.
In New York, yes.
Yes. And I was thinking, I mean, basically the song is about how my wife, Kathy, handled this really scary thing right after we had a kid. This really crazy, reckless thing, it seemed like. A guy in a spacesuit comes in and puts a pill on your tongue, and they say, okay, just take a cab home, but sit as far away from the driver as possible. And then she had to lock herself in her apartment for at least 7 days. And I took our son upstate just to assure that we wouldn't, be tempted. And I thought, this is crazy reckless, And I was thinking about those particles and how are we constantly being lacerated by these subatomic particles? What is cancer? I mean, that's my question for you tonight. I guess what I'm wondering is and maybe there's been discussions of this or not, but does cancer have a purpose? There seems to be some genetic, it seems to be in our genetic code to some degree, and then there's environmental. But is there some reason cancer exists?
If I told you, then the song wouldn't happen, right? Yeah. It occurs because we're constantly bombarded by radiation from the sun and from outer space, and our DNA undergo mutations all the time. We generate a cancer cell almost every day, and your body clears it out. And we have a defense mechanism that is really good at clearing it out. And yet, every once in a while, one can get through. And the longer you live, the more likely it gets through. And the shocking thing is it can nonetheless get through when you're a child. It can get through in young age, like you guys. And go onward. And the fantastic news is she's doing great. But but nonetheless, it is one of the few ways in which we're aware of our fragility, unlike a century ago, when you could get a flu, you could get a broken leg, you could get a strep throat. George Washington died from a strep throat. 3 days later, he was dead because we didn't have treatment for it.
Right.
And so I think it's still are being in touch with the fact that we're still animal, mortal beings.
I like to write about things that I don't understand, and let's not get to the bottom of it tonight. Let's not.
Exactly. But I don't have anything to write about.
The other part of that song is the reason why it's so upbeat is because it's more, there's other lines there that are about how my wife dealt with the scary thing with a sense of humor and grace, that impressed the crud out of me. But it was just, the line of we were on our way to get some test results and we knew something wasn't right. And she said, I'm afraid they're going to tell me I'm a girl and not a puma, which is an inside joke to some degree. But I just thought it was amazing that she was able to think that way, and it's such a scary moment. Like, anyway, she has kind of a very feline fixation and embodies that as well. So anyway.
I think this album, though, has done so well because it is accessible at times, and then other times when, I didn't understand what Puma was about. I knew there was something personal in it, but it brought out something that was just at another level of connection, and that's what makes it art and what makes it beautiful with the music interplay, interplaying with the lyrics, And I think there are those many moments, you know, valleys of the young, which struck me as on one level being straightforwardly about having a child and suddenly not being connected to those people who have brunches and sleep in late every day. And yet there seems to be a whole nother layer to it that I never could guess or understand. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I mean, and I say that for the last verse, which gets kind of brutal. Talking about, it's based on an actual, something that a friend of mine went through, but it imagines two parents that are going to the aid of their adult child who's just tried to commit suicide, but they're at the end of their life or quite a bit, you know, they're still in that parent mode of like going to the aid of their child, who's in middle age, you know? So it's, that was kind of a sucker punch in the song, because I'm talking otherwise about these more superficial things that happen in urban environments between people who have kids and don't, and that chasm between, which is something to talk about. But this last verse was like, I'm going to grab you by the collar. Make sure you're really listening, you know?
Well, I want to thank Andrew Bird for the time we've had to mine a little bit of your life and music. You're an amazing person and musician, and we're in for a treat with you playing solo on stage and constructing your music in front of us. So I'd like to have a warm round of applause for Andrew Bird.
Andrew Bird talking with Atul Gawande, surgeon, author, and music fanatic. In a minute, we'll hear some live music from Andrew Bird. This is a special edition of the New Yorker Radio Hour, live from the New Yorker Festival. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. A minute ago, we heard medical reporter and music nut Atul Gawande interviewing the indie singer-songwriter Andrew Bird. Here's Bird playing a song called Capsized off his record Are You Serious, which came out earlier this year.
Thank you.
last forever. Someone is by your side. Pull it together, darling, you're not alone. But when you break up, sky's falling, no one is on your side. Spoon of the laundry, darling, you're all alone. Jesus gonna make my, and it's a Holy Ghost religion. It's a Holy Ghost religion. Jesus gonna make my. And when you wake up. Pull it together, darling, you're not alone. But when you break up, sky's falling, no one is on your side. Spoon to the laundry, darling, you're all alone. And when you wake up, another sunrise, another break up, your ship is.
Andrew Bird playing Capsized at the New Yorker Festival. I'm David Remnick, and we've got more highlights of the New Yorker Festival in store for you in the coming months. John Goodman talking with The New Yorker's Lawrence Wright, comedian Sarah Silverman with Andy Borowitz, and I'll talk with a guy named Bruce Springsteen. We'll save that one for a little Thanksgiving treat. And to wrap things up today, here's Andrew Bird playing Left-Handed Kisses. Thank you.
take such pains that she won't notice you. Then your ex rays of your paleo male oh gaze, how they rest and play slowly corrupting you. I wonder what the chances you wanted to. A thousand vacant stares won't make it you. Know you're there. From the tips of your fingers, I have a strand of hair. To know someone's watching you, watching me, watching you, and all that we look upon. You may not know me, but you feel my stare. And if she sees you, it changes you, rearranges your molecules. See how it changes her. She's a danger now after school. And if she sees you, it changes you, rearranges your molecules. If you see how it changes her, she'll be seeing you after school. He's a gentleman of her eyes. Maybe she's a gentleman in disguise.
Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botin, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Rhonda Sherman, Sarah Edwards, David Ohana, Alexis Goldberg, and Bradley G. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.